We're now going to convene the Task Force on Impediments to Fair Housing. Any remarks by co-chair? Well, at this time we're going to get right into the presentation. Francesca.
Good afternoon. My name is Francesca Provenzano. I work for the State Health Department. I'm coordinator for the Lead, Radon, and Healthy Homes programs. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today about childhood lead poisoning prevention in the state of Connecticut and how it intersects with voucher-based programs. I chose that. Feel free to ask me questions throughout the presentation, though. I had to pick and choose 15 minutes. So. Just to give you an idea of what our program does, the main focus of the State Department of Public Health Lead and Healthy Homes program is to provide oversight and technical assistance to 74 local health departments in the state and districts. We provide them with technical assistance on our regulations. We also conduct disease surveillance. You'll see all the pretty pictures in my slide presentation on that. As part of the disease surveillance, we look at medical provider compliance with childhood lead testing, the incidence and prevalence rates on an annual basis, sources of exposure for childhood lead poisoning, and abatement remediation actions. We also deliver around $1 million a year in lead poisoning prevention funds to the health department, and we gear that toward prevention and response. Every community uses it differently. We audit and do compliance checks for our licensed workforce of lead abatement contractors and lead consulting contractors. So we take legal action against them if it's warranted. And we also collaborate with multiple agencies throughout the state to coordinate our actions and further prevent childhood lead poisoning. And when I say multiple agencies, I mean basically everyone. We're friends with everyone. I call it our wall of fame. We take photos. So a really short summary on childhood lead testing. 2009, it was effective. State law changed. It was drafted 2008, effective January 1st, 2009. That, in short, all children are tested at least two times before they turn 3 years of age. Okay. If not, the pediatrician has not tested that child, then before they turn six, they'd get tested as well. Okay. Typically, that's a capillary test, which means a finger stick. And if that finger stick result is greater than 5, then our guidelines in the state are to have that child go through venous blood lead testing, which is a draw from the arm. Okay, so it is law in Connecticut. When you look at annual report numbers, I want you to know these are actually, I just finalized our report, so you're the first to see this publicly. For our 2012 data. When you look at it, the screening numbers have increased over time. I don't particularly like this table because in any given 12-month period, every child shouldn't be tested. A child could get tested December 31st, skip 14 months, and then get tested the following year. So you're never going to have 100% on this. At most, you'd maybe have 70%. So when you look at these numbers, it's not that we're only testing 67% of kids. It's true for 1 and 2 year olds, but of those, how many really needed a test in that 12-month period? So what we do instead is we look at a birth cohort. We take the children, since the law became effective in 2009, those kids in 2012 were 3 years old. So that's our first set of data where we can say, how many kids are actually getting tested? Well, the total number of children tested by age 2, that is up to, right, 2 years of age, is 84.6%. When we take that same birth cohort and look at them by the time they turn 3, 97.6% of them were tested for lead, which is great compliance. The downfall to it, and I don't hide our flaws, this is something we need to work on, is that they're supposed to be tested twice. And what we can see is pediatricians are not testing them twice. Once at the age of around 1, and then again at the age of 2 to 3. Okay. So when you look at all children, because don't forget, if a child isn't tested by 3, then they have to get tested again sometime before they turn 6. When we look at those children and the year of birth, what we're seeing is around 95.7% of children are being tested at least one time before they turn 6 years of age. That's phenomenal. I'm just going to pat myself on the back with that one. Actually, my staff, I have amazing staff. Okay. When you step back and look at that over time, it's pretty amazing as well. Some of this obviously has to go to our legislature who bothered to pass mandatory testing laws. If you look at this graph, you can see in 2008 we had around 1.4% of our child population had a 10 microgram per deciliter level of blood lead or more, and then you start seeing it drop. We believe that the childhood lead testing requirements in the state led to early diagnosis and a decrease in lead poisoning for children. When you look at the numbers, the actual raw numbers, not a percent, look to the far right, I'll explain the yellow bar in a little bit. You've also seen a steady decline even in raw numbers of children poisoned in our state. In 2013, we started adopting the CDC's reference value, which the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention now define childhood lead poisoning as any level confirmed at or above 5 micrograms per deciliter. So we went from defining it at 10 micrograms now down to 5. Okay, so that's why that yellow bar is there, that outlier. So we're going to start tracking that number of children now. So let's look at those even closer up. Do you like how I'm drilling down here? Hope so. So we have 2,261 children in 2012 who had a blood lead level greater than or equal to 5 micrograms per deciliter. As you move over, it goes down to 522 when it's 10 and above. When you look at greater than 15, it's 196. And then greater than 20, you have 107. So does that make sense to everybody? So they're additive, and that's why we did the color coding. Okay. So what you see is we have a high number of children with low levels of lead exposure and a low number of children with high levels of lead exposure. And that number seems to decrease each year as well. For instance, last year it was 112, the 2011 data. What I don't like about our data, and this is where I start nagging our local health departments as well as medical practitioners throughout the state, is I don't feel we're actually preventing lead poisoning. So when you look at the total numbers, we're looking at the total burden of childhood lead poisoning in that given year. But when you break it down by new cases, which is the incidence rate, then what you see is the majority of cases out of that 2,200 that I was referencing are all new cases. They're not existing ones from the year prior that were carryovers and the child's still exposed at some level. So this is the area where I think our program is going to be working toward prevention. We've already started doing that in 2013, recognizing this trend, but it's alarming to me. If we could prevent lead poisoning, then the rates would drop significantly. So what causes lead poisoning? I kind of skipped that in the beginning because I think most of you are well versed on it, but typically children are exposed to lead hazards through housing. Pre-1978 homes have lead-based paint hazards, which would include contaminated dust, exterior soil that's exposed that they mouth, as well as sometimes drinking water or other sources like hobbies, take-home exposure from a father or mother who's a painter, crafts, Ayurvedic medicines, herbal remedies, things of that nature. Okay. All in all, what we found when we do investigations of severe lead poisonings for children is that over 90% of the properties, more than that, always have a lead hazard. And it's usually a combination of more than one. There's usually deteriorated paint as well as dust or soil contamination. So if you look at Connecticut in terms of its housing...
Excuse me. Yes. I might be jumping forward a little bit, but yeah. Do you know of those properties, are they disproportionately subsidized housing of some sort? Are we talking people who are living in Section 8 housing or RAP housing or
somewhere? I do have some slides on that. They'll be coming up. So I wanted to kind of build to that to give you like the whole picture. I wanted to give you a little background that 88% of our population lives in these urban areas because I have some nice maps for this. And the housing stock... In Connecticut in general, 78% of it is prior to 1980, which is that 1978 cutoff for lead paint. But if you really think about 1960 or earlier, you're really going to have a really high likelihood of there being lead-based paint in those properties. And for that, we have a very high percent in Connecticut because we're obviously an older state. So here's 2011 data. We didn't have it ready for 2012. But if I overlay households and incomes below poverty level in Connecticut, this isn't in your packet. I added it before I came. And these are just dots. I want you to know these aren't the exact addresses of lead-poisoned children on this map, and we're not disclosing any confidential health data with this because the dots are equivalent to around 2 miles, and in the urban centers, I have to spread them out so you can see them. So they're not, you know, really accurate locations, so therefore not identifiable. But what you can see is, as you see a higher level of poverty in our urban centers, you also see a concentration of more dots, right? So there's an association. That's what you call an association. If you look at that from the age of housing, the darker the green color, the older the percentage of housing is in that particular municipality. And once again, what you see for housing units, where there are more housing units that are pre-1960, you see more lead poisoning. Okay. So this map, I do healthy homes too. I want to point out that this map could be a picture of asthma. You could put that up there too. You could put a lot of other urban health disparity issues and overlay them, and you're going to see the same trend in our state. When you look at the number of lead poisonings in these towns, once again, it's your big five cities in the state. Just New Haven and Bridgeport alone in Connecticut account for over 40% of our lead poisoning cases, and the most severe ones tend to occur in both New Haven and Bridgeport as well. But we have Waterbury, Hartford, and New Britain that also are up there. They're the second tier, I call them. When you look at children under six and the higher rates of lead poisoning that I was just talking about, and the more severe cases of lead poisoning, once again, the bigger the yellow circle, the more cases. And once again, you see New Haven and Bridgeport as the biggest circles, with New Britain, Meriden, Waterbury, Hartford as your second tier levels. So if you recall, you still see rates of lead poisoning pretty low in our state. And what are those factors that contribute to it? And this is where I get into some of the housing. First, you should be aware, if you aren't already, that HUD passed a law both in 1992 and in 2000 they became effective. I call it all the Lead Safe Housing Rule, or people sometimes call it Title 10, but there are a lot of Title 10. So this is the HUD Title 10. 1018 disclosure requires that when you buy or sell a property, you rent a property, if it's pre-78, you need to disclose to renters that there could be lead-based paint hazards. If you've ever done an inspection, then you'd have to disclose those inspection findings to the person renting or buying. Okay. 24 CFR Part 35 is really the bulk of the HUD Lead Safe Housing Rule. There are subparts A through double Z, not really. It's probably around R, the alphabet. And subpart M is the voucher-based housing programs that you were asking about, Mr. Rodriguez. So under subpart M, there are requirements that the homes be lead safe. There are obviously the project-based housing requirements for the lead safe housing rule. Project-based housing is a little easier because it's stationary. It's a fixed location. You know the units. You can go in there, do an investment, abate those units, and you're all set, right? But when you're talking about voucher-based programs, that population of homes changes, right? Each year, people drop out, people come in. And so that's kind of a moving target. So it requires vigilance on the part of Section 8 voucher-based program administrators. So that's one factor that helped reduce childhood lead poisoning rates. Another is Connecticut statutes and regulations. I talked about the pediatric testing, which provides for early diagnosis. It prevents children from getting severely poisoned. We also have the local health funding support I explained to you earlier, and our childhood lead poisoning prevention control regs. I'll give you a little overview in a couple slides on that. We also have HUD grantees in Connecticut, and the HUD grantees in Connecticut, what I mean by that is for lead hazard control grants. And if you look at those maps earlier that I showed you where you have your highest rates of lead poisoning, each of those communities basically has some source of funding from HUD to deal with it, with the exception of New Britain, I believe. So Bridgeport, New Haven, Waterbury, and Hartford all have their own municipal HUD lead hazard control grants. In addition to that, the State Department of Social Services is awarded funding, which they actually act as a pass-through to CCMC, Connecticut Children's Medical Center, and their LAMP program, which operates in all of those high lead towns, high lead rate towns. Okay. We also have two more bullets. The EPA renovation, remodeling, and painting rule went into effect in 2010. That requires for anyone, with the exception of zero-bedroom dwelling units or, for instance, dormitory rooms or designated elderly housing, that anyone who disturbs lead-based or pre-1978 paint on a residential property has to do it using lead-safe work practices. They also need to be certified as a firm by the US EPA, and their workers need to be trained in lead-safe work practices. So, in the simple version, in 2013 and 14, we really shouldn't see any exterior paint sanding activities anywhere in the state of Connecticut. That would be breaking federal laws. Okay. So as of April 2010, the RRP rule was in effect. So even if you don't have children on your property, a contractor is required by law to use lead-safe work practices when repainting your home.
Quick follow-up. Mm-hmm. Do the HUD lead safe housing rules, the Title 10 HUD, do they apply to the state's RAP vouchers?
I think they apply to any federally assisted housing programs. So I don't know if RAP is what, the weatherization?
No, it's a state-funded rental assistance program, so I don't think they apply.
Unless there's some federal funding mechanism to it.
Okay. Thank you.
There's still an intersection with our lead regulations, though. I should be aware. So everyone always asks me to talk about housing and how it relates with lead. And so we have the data. You've seen that in all our maps. So it tells a nice story. But this is where I interject, as I put my Healthy Homes hat on and say it's really not just about lead. It's about a lot of housing factors that impact people's health. I mentioned asthma a little earlier. And just substandard housing in general can lead to poor health outcomes. That's called the social determinants of health. So when you look at lead poisoning response in Connecticut, I'm giving you the quickest, shortest overview of a set of around 25 pages of regulations. So this is not at all complete. And I'm basing this on blood lead levels for children under the age of 6. Here are your local health responsibilities under our regulations. Now, before I go through this, I would like to say that if a professional or someone takes a valid paint chip sample from a home and a child under the age of 6 is in residence, and that paint happens to be lead-based paint, then there is also a requirement by a local health department to conduct lead abatement on that property, and that's a piece of our prevention activities. What I'm talking about here is more the response activities. So what do we do? Local health is required when a child has a confirmed level of 5 micrograms per deciliter or more to follow up. If it's a capillary or finger stick level, they send a reminder letter to the parents and to ensure there's pediatric follow-up. When the venous result comes back, if it is greater than 5, they also send them educational materials, nutrition, sources of lead exposure, the Birth to 3 program, and how our regulations apply. It's a packet. If a child comes in and they have a 10 microgram per deciliter level, whether or not it's a capillary or venous, they're going to get the educational materials for risk reduction. If a child has 2 venous blood lead levels, 15 to 19, more than 3 months apart, then what is required is the health department has to go out and conduct a comprehensive lead inspection of the property. They test all the painted surfaces, do dust wipes in several rooms, sample exposed soil and water for that property to identify sources of lead exposure, and then they issue orders to the property owner to have it abated. If a child has 1 venous blood lead level greater than 20, it not only triggers the comprehensive lead inspection, but also a multi-page questionnaire to identify other sources of lead exposure. And on that questionnaire, we ask, are you receiving housing assistance for your rental? Okay. So this is important for you to understand because we only collect that detailed information on Section 8 or voucher-based programs for the 20 and above. So looking back at those numbers, what I have data on that's very specific are basically the 100 or so cases a year that we get. Some health departments do the investigation, ask further questions at lower blood leads, so we have some additional data.
I have a follow-up for you.
Mm-hmm.
Are children tested in school, or do the parents have to take them to a doctor?
They typically take them to a doctor, although some local health departments also offer little clinics, or they offer finger stick testing at a WIC clinic, for instance, in the town offices. But typically it's a pediatric appointment. At the same time, for instance, the one-year checkup, when they do the hemoglobin check for a kid, they'll also do another pipette of their finger blood to do the blood lead test. So they kind of integrate it into other shots and pokes.
So let's take a scenario. A child breaks his leg. Parents don't have insurance. Child is not signed up for insurance. Child breaks his leg.
Mm-hmm.
Goes to the emergency room.
Mm-hmm.
Will they test for lead?
They probably wouldn't because that's such an acute injury. The focus would be more on a broken bone. But we do also fund two lead treatment centers and clinics in Connecticut, one in Yale, one in Hartford. We do send advisory letters to pediatricians. In an acute emergency situation like a broken leg, I don't know if they'd necessarily test. But if they're going in because they're having trouble breathing or, they go in for a clinic, he's had sniffles for a couple weeks, pink eye, things like that, they'll ask those questions at that point and try to do a finger stick for the child. If they're uninsured, the state laboratory will process the sample for free of charge. If a child has any insurance, public, private, then that's reimbursed through the insurance provider.
Thank you.
We have seen a slight reduction when the economy gets in parents bringing their kids to pediatricians, things like that. So I think it's impacting some of our screening rates. All right. So perfect storm or coincidence, I don't know. In 2011, I started looking at the numbers, and, urban centers have the highest percentage of pre-1950s housing. They have the greatest concentration of people living in poverty. They're the highest rates of lead poisoning in our state. So I always call up and say, what can we do to help you? I like to see your rates go down, especially New Haven and Bridgeport. 40% plus of our rates, lead poisoning cases are there. So, I call and ask. So I just called New Haven and Bridgeport. They said, we're doing pretty good. And then one of them said, Fran, we're doing what we can, but I think it's the Section 8 housing program. I keep going out to all these things. I'm going out and responding, and they should be doing this. So someone's complaining. Then I run into a colleague at a conference. This is all within a business week. She says, I just visited home, and it had a red-tagged furnace, and there were Section 8 people living there. How does that happen? I'm like, I don't know. Why is everyone telling me about the Section 8 all of a sudden? Is what I'm thinking, right? Then I get a call from my colleague, Marion Heyman. She does a lot of indoor environmental quality, fields a lot of those calls. And she goes, Fran, I've been getting tons of calls about mold mildew complaints. They're all Section 8. So I said, all right, let me go to my manager, Suzanne Blankaflor. This is, maybe it just happens to be an odd week, but maybe we need to look at this. People were bumping into me, and I swear to God, it was 5 business days this all happened. And I said, all right, I didn't think this was an issue. We have the lead safe housing rule in place. Most units should be lead safe. I remember before coming to the state training, DECD staff on this, the communities are in the know about it. So I thought, this isn't happening. Well, I went back to Tracy, our epidemiologist, and I asked her to run some numbers. Because we had on those severely lead poisoned cases the question, do you receive housing assistance? And the data revealed that approximately 10% of all children who were severely poisoned in Connecticut were poisoned in subsidized housing of some type. So it was also self-reported by parents. I have to, full disclosure on that. But I wondered if it was the tip of the iceberg, because We only had data for severely poisoned children, and it's underreported. The response rate on that was pretty low. One of the reasons is we were trying to get all of our paper copies into a new disease surveillance system that was electronic. So we skipped some of the questions. So I said, all right, moving forward, we need to start making sure that question's filled out. Okay? And can we bring some partners together to discuss this? The backdrop to that is, here's my little story about lead poisoning, is in a community in Connecticut, there were three children residing in a single family rental unit. They were all under the age of six. One of my epis came to me and said, routine lead screening indicated they all had high capillary results. Well, when they did the venous tests for the children, two of them were above 44 micrograms per deciliter. That's at a level that causes permanent damage, and where they have outpatient services, but they provide them with chelation therapy, which is a drug therapy that pulls the heavy metals out of your body. It's kind of a last resort, and the reason it's a last resort is because it also makes children anemic, because it's pulling out the iron in their system.
Could it be that some families who are in subsidized housing of some sort are hesitant to report that they're in subsidized housing fear that they will be kicked out or something in that order?
I do think there's a stigma associated with it, or could be, and that's why I say self-reported in terms of what we have for data. So some people say yes, and other people say no or nothing. So there is a possibility, once again, of under-reporting for that reason as well, yes. So the 10% can be looked at as a very conservative estimate in a sense. So the two children were hospitalized and treated. The family immediately relocated to a lead-safe house where a lead inspection was done by the local health department. And a lead inspection was done at the previous residence as well, because that was a source of lead exposure. And the EPI form was completed to determine any other additional sources. The residence where they were living when they first got poisoned identified defective lead paint on interior surfaces, high dust lead levels on floors, windowsills, and wells, high levels in the soil, and defective exterior window casings and components. So the local health department issued an order for lead abatement for all hazards, and the children were medically case managed, and their lead levels continue to go down. But when you look at that timeline, it's February 2011 that the HQS inspection, Housing Quality Standard inspection, was done by voucher-based program, whoever that was. The family relocated to that new residence. All three children were severely poisoned within a few months, and the comprehensive lead inspection indicated gross amounts of lead-based paint that were highly defective on that property. So in summary, this was a completely preventable lead poisoning, to give you an example of that story, where what we saw is a unit that shouldn't have had any deteriorated paint but did. It wasn't due to patterns by the tenant. In a three-month period, they didn't all of a sudden go out and make the exterior and all these surfaces defective. This was the case at the time of the rental. So we convened a work group. We knew enough at that point to say, okay, this may be an issue, an emerging issue. So who did we bring in or invite? All of these partners. I'm not going to read them all. Some of them are even in the room, right? So there you go. CONNARO is a nonprofit organization that represents essentially or helps public housing authorities. Okay. It's a national association. It's a Connecticut chapter. I think you all know the rest of the acronyms here. Yes. So what did our work group meetings, what have we done? We've had around eight, and I have to be honest that in the beginning it was just understanding what everyone does. We spent several meetings doing that, going around the table and connecting the dots. So we learned about subsidized housing programs in Connecticut. For those of you who aren't familiar with it in the audience, there isn't just one Section 8. There's Connecticut's version, there's Section 8 through the federal government. How it's delivered is by different contractors, sometimes directly by cities. So there are multiple mechanisms for the delivery of that funding for voucher-based programs. It's very complex. So that took a while to just understand. We also went through the housing quality standard inspection requirements, their frequency, the quality of training that industry professionals receive. We learned about Connecticut Human Rights Opportunities Commission and fair housing laws, that there's no such thing as someone saying, oh, I don't rent to Section 8 people, right? So also sharing that with partners. Learned about housing and health code enforcement. We have Judy DeCine as part of our work group, so she brings lots to the table that intersects with our lead poisoning laws. We also have statewide initiatives in a backdrop to enhance our efforts. The Broken Windows Program, which Judy works with police on that initiative related to housing in urban centers. Healthy Homes Initiative, which I administer, lead, the RRP rule, weatherization activities through United Illuminating and CLMP, and blight task forces throughout the state. We also learned about resources for property owners. And then we discussed how voucher-based programs respond to housing complaints. And what we found is typically, and this is in accordance with HUD guidelines, that if there are deficiencies, they typically issue a letter to the property owner, and within 30 days, they should correct those deficiencies. If they don't, after 90 days, they pretty much drop them out of the program. But there's no referral made for that property owner to housing or health departments in that local municipality. So if Fran Provenzano has a rental property and there are housing defects and I no longer correct those housing defects, so the voucher-based person has to go to a different property, well, then I just rent it to somebody who's not in Section 8. But that doesn't make it right either. From a public health perspective, those corrections should still be made.
Are there any funds available, let's say, if you were the property owner, to do the work, or does it come out of your pocket?
There are several funds available in the state. It just takes a little persistence. In the urban centers I've mentioned, as well as 16 communities in the state, you can receive HUD funding if you're found to be eligible for that funding. If you aren't, CHIF, Connecticut Housing Investment Fund, offers low-interest loans. There are also community development block grant funds through either Small Cities Grant T program or Entitlement Communities, where you can receive funding. So that was part of our work group as well. But there are several resources for property owners in the state, from low-interest loans, unsecured loans, actual grant money, so it's free, and a blend of those.
Do you know what the utilization is? Are property owners actually using it? Do they know about it? Is it too difficult to access?
It is used because the HUD grants, they run out of money. We also saw it with CRT in their home program. They run out of money. So I think what we have is not enough money to carry out lead abatement in the state, but not a lack of demand. So potential work objectives, we've looked at, and you know, these are just discussions, but I thought this committee would be interested in it, a statewide property maintenance code. We don't have one in the state of Connecticut, okay? So adoption of one. Enhanced enforcement of housing and health codes. Increased collaboration, I call that referral versus deferral. So if you're in a voucher-based program and you find housing deficiencies, refer that to the local housing code enforcement official. Health and Housing Code Enforcement Official, instead of walking away. I have some sub-bullets there. Under 24 CFR 35 subpart M, which is your voucher-based program, the person or entity that administers the voucher-based program is supposed to share the property list with their local health director on a quarterly basis. So that way, if a child comes up as, let's say, having a somewhat elevated level of lead in their blood, the director of health could collaborate with the housing-based voucher program administrator to address those lead hazards in the property before the child becomes severely lead poisoned. It would be good to know that property list. Under federal law, they're supposed to be sharing it. It also relates to sharing that burden of inspections and response policies. Yes?
Yes, Fran. The blight task force that you mentioned earlier is actually wrestling with that statewide property maintenance code because there's such a variation between our municipalities in terms of what they they have presently that it's really tough to come up with some uniform code, because some towns have virtually nothing and some have the far-reaching, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, but that's one of the areas that the task force is actually wrestling with right now. So hopefully we'll see the results of their labors soon.
It's all connected.
Yes.
I know Judy Dessine has been an advocate for that.
Oh, yeah.
We've educated a variety of groups on the impact of substandard housing conditions on health status of populations. We continue to do that. We've educated different groups. We had CHRO present on housing laws and a case history for voucher-based programs and some cases they have to the Healthy Homes Initiative Committee. And we've done educational programs for different housing authorities. Tomorrow, one of my staff will be presenting to 48 individuals registered for CONNARO. But we've also done three other presentations for J. D'Amelia, Connection, Inc., and the other large Section 8 folks, right? So we've done training and education. We'll continue to do that when the opportunities present themselves. So I told you about 2011. Well, when I had Tracy, my EPI, run numbers yesterday, I had a little short notice on this presentation, but she ran them yesterday for me. And if you look at our calendar year 2012 data, and we started making sure we entered that information into our system, then it showed we had, it was really 17.7%, but I rounded it up to 18. but 18% of those severely poisoned children, the ones above 20, resided in subsidized housing at the time of poisoning. So that's 22 cases out of 124 in our disease surveillance system. Once again, it's parents self-reported, which is a weakness. And we had this time a 70% response rate on that question with a yes or a no, right? So 30% was no response. So even if you look at it conservatively, if you apply that 15% to all cases 5 and above that are confirmed in our state, then you're looking at 339 children who are exposed to lead hazards who otherwise shouldn't be. If you round it up to 20% based on underreporting and you know, educated guess, it's probably a little more than 18%, then you're looking at 452 children based on our 2012 data.
And these are children in subsidized housing?
Correct. And that's, there are extra slides in there I gave you for informational purposes, but this is where I was going to end my presentation.
Well, that's fine. It's a great presentation. I have a lot of interest in your whole presentation. I hope to have an informational forum in a couple of weeks that actually touch on this very subject. So I have a lot of questions. First of all, I'm kind of amazed. I would think over time that we would see some of these numbers decline. And the one slide that showed about the 2,000 or so cases, that like 1,600 of them were new cases.
Yes.
What do you attribute to that? Yes, that one. Because that sounds to be, you would think it would be reversed.
You would think that we'd have a higher prevalence rate over time and that fewer new children would be poisoned, but it's not what we're finding. I think part of that reflects that a lot of pediatricians are testing at that one-year-old age group. So that first test we get in that calendar year, don't forget this is a calendar year, is always going to reflect a new case, right? So for a calendar year when we're collecting our data, for any child who's between the age of 1 and 2, that birth cohort, that's their first test. Seeing 1,647 reflects a lot of old housing in our state, right? That we still have lead hazards. And to me, that we still have poverty, nutrition issues, and that we place people in those areas of the state where we have the highest concentration of pre-1950 housing, in those urban centers where even you have atmospheric fallout from leaded gasoline, just environmental justice. But I think, you know, if you look at public health data, I want to say this, that we've seen there were town forums that were held by the department, that there were increases in, for instance, pertussis beyond what we've ever seen prior 5 years, 10 years of collecting data. And when you start seeing things like pertussis increase, it reflects that children aren't getting shots from their pediatricians, right? Think about the pertussis shots that you're supposed to get for immunizations and vaccinations. So I think what we've seen in this, the outcome of this economic fallout from 2007, 2008, is children's health slightly declined too. And that should be taken into account. I don't like it either. I don't have a good answer for you.
Okay. It's just amazing to see this. But also I'd like to, while we're still on the slide, the higher numbers of those blood levels, what kind of symptoms do these children have? I mean, can they have like the 10, 15 levels and just seem to be normal? Or where would they start showing some symptoms that something's wrong?
We have done research in Connecticut looking specifically at children who had not had prior high levels of lead. The highest they'd ever had was 10 or less. And we compared that to their CMT scores. So even at subtle levels, lower levels below 10, we see a drop in CMT scores for both math and reading for all children. We work with the State Department of Ed to match that data to students. So it's not generalizing from another state's research. It's our state. So at low levels, you see educational scores drop on CMTs. Some children remain asymptomatic. Some children as low as 10 may have behavioral things, hyperactivity. Some children get stomach cramping, hearing trouble. Those tend to get exaggerated or become exaggerated as lead levels increase in that child.
And I'm going to just have one more couple of questions. Anyways, it seems to me with all of the funding that's out there and that we will start seeing some of this go down too, when the utilization of all these funds, we know those, you know, that people are doing remediation because they're using the funds.
Mm-hmm.
So it's happening. But yet we're seeing so many new cases. It's just a little curious. I want you to speak to that, and I'll ask my last question and then open it up to the rest of the panel here. I want your thoughts on that. But also, aren't all these subsidized housing, don't they have testing of these houses that...
What happens...
Is there no... Formal, it's for Section 8. I mean,
right.
They look to see if his house is appropriate for Section 8.
Right.
Part of that review, do they, if there's children, if they're going to rent to children, do they not have to have some lead test?
Under Subpart M for HUD, there is a requirement that if there's deteriorated paint, you can either presume it's lead-based paint in a pre-1978 property and treat it accordingly, or you test for it, correct? So that upon placement of a family, even without children, into a voucher-based program housing, Section 8 housing, that there should be no apparent lead hazards. And what I mean by that is there are no deteriorated painted surfaces in common areas, exterior, ancillary structures, or interior of the property. So that should be occurring. What we've found through investigations is that's not actually occurring.
A follow-up to that.
All circumstances. I won't say 100% not occurring.
You mentioned that in project-based Section 8. It's easier because it's a fixed facility, right?
Right. It's a stationary location.
Right. But if someone's vouchers, Section 8 vouchers are mobile, So someone, let's say, moves to a different apartment complex. Before they move into that complex or a unit in that complex, does it have to meet HUD rules?
Correct. It should.
It should.
It's supposed to be inspected prior to placement of the family. so that they accept that unit into the voucher-based program. So, and that housing quality inspection state law has shown that it's no more extensive than if you own a house and comply with housing laws anyway. So there's no distinction between, I want to make this clear, between Section 8 housing and somebody who rents a three-family. There are housing standards in our state so that if certain, for instance, if there's defective paint and it's pre-1978, under Connecticut General Statute 47A 52F, it also needs to be corrected. So whether you're in a voucher-based program or not, there shouldn't be a lead hazard. There's an added layer of safety for the voucher-based program because they not only go through routine inspections, but they're supposed to also go through inspections prior to, obviously, their being set up in the program. So there's this ongoing cycle of inspections and walkthroughs by the entities that inspect in our state.
Of Section 8. Mm-hmm. But this, I refer this to Aaron, and I wonder to what extent is the increase, could it be because of the RAP program? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, one last thing. The report you mentioned linking CMT scores to lead, mm-hmm. is that available to the task force?
It is. It's on our website. And just to show you, let me see if I have it right on my jump drive. But yes, I think my colleague Kim did a couple slides. I advised her to for her presentation tomorrow. I didn't want to be that long. I thought there would be other people presenting today. So here we have CMT scores. So here's the Miranda study, and these are all for blood lead levels below 10 where children have never been exposed at. For instance, they weren't 20 at one point in their lifetime and then came down to a 10. They were excluded from this study. These children were children who never had high blood lead levels. All right, it only went up to 10.
Okay, thank you. Right. Peter, could you distribute that to the task force, please? Thank you.
You want me to email it to you? Okay. I'll send you the slides. So this one is for reading, and here you see it for math. So you're seeing a decline. There's a glitch because the population, N for our study ends up being very much smaller because you exclude kids who ever had a higher blood lead level. You exclude kids who didn't have CMT scores, so as you narrow it down. And I think this one is percentage below basic performance standard for reading test versus blood lead level test by race. I think someone in the audience is interested in that. So here you have white versus black. I can actually email you the full reports, the research papers. And here for mathematics, white versus black.
Okay. Thank you, Erin.
So thank you, Francesca. It's great to have this data. For the purposes of this task force, I wanted to put it in context a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously we're looking at impediments to fair housing, and this piece of it, the health piece actually is an impact. It's not an impediment to fair housing. It's it's what happens when you don't have access to housing all over the place. So it's really connecting place and race and health. And just sort of to take the steps through the logic of this, we're talking about the fact that blacks and Latinos in Connecticut have income that is 50% that of whites or less. We're talking about the fact that people living in subsidized housing, and here I'm talking about specifically Section 8, are 78% minority. So those two groups are, what we're really talking about when we're looking at these numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And that because of the way we're basically using older housing stock to meet our affordable housing and subsidized housing need to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
And this leads to a greater exposure to lead. And really, when you go all the way through the steps, it what it means for minority kids is that they're more likely to have lower test scores because they've had neural damage potentially because of lead. I mean, is that sort of, does that logic work?
The The funding for that research didn't even come from the Department of Public Health. It came from the State Department of Education and the LAMP project based out of DSS. And the question they were asking when they did that research for State Department of Ed and CMT scores was, is part of the education gap attributable to lead exposure? Mm-hmm. So when you correct for things like free lunch, they took those confounding factors into consideration when they finalized their data. And the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. You know, that lead does contribute to the education gap in our state. I think I would have preferred, you know, from a purely research perspective, that they looked at levels all the way up to 100, mm-hmm. right, not limiting it to 10 or less. I think they were also trying to prove the point that at very low blood lead levels, children were still negatively impacted, and that the state of Connecticut wasn't defining that as lead poisoning. Since this report and the CDC came out with national reports, they've dropped what they used to call the action level was 10. Down to 5 now. It's a reference value. And that's why you see the 2,000 number, this new column of so many cases, because we defined lead poisoning differently. We cut the level in half, essentially. So when you do look at that, you know, where are the voucher-based programs concentrated, it's in communities where you have the oldest housing in the state, primarily. And to a certain extent, in urban settings, to a certain extent, absentee landlords, and all of those factors complicate or add to health outcomes, like you were talking about, but also less educational attainment, less opportunity. If we're going to talk about it, you look at the social determinants of health. And I teach this kind of stuff. And so when you look at it, you and I have a lot of opportunities and choices in terms of where we live, what we eat, when we go shopping. But when you start whittling away and put people in a food desert, or you put them only in pre-1950s housing, you start taking away some of these health choices that the rest of us can easily make. And we particularly do it for low-income people across our nation. I'm not going to point fingers at Connecticut. This happens nationwide. It's a well-studied fact that you can determine your health outcome by your zip code. And those health disparities are social determinants of health, one of which is housing, where you live, geographic location.
And just to follow up on that, you know, from what I've read, there are sort of a growing body of studies that point to this, and some of the types of health outcomes that have been connected to place include diabetes, depression,
heart disease,
cancer,
chronic diseases.
In some cases,
right.
There's been
asthma.
Some correlation with asthma, right? So,
mm-hmm.
You know, basically, I mean, one thing I'm very interested in is basically the cost of what we're doing. We are imposing a tremendous health cost in a way that has a racial element to it. And it's related back to the way we're doing affordable and subsidized housing in the state. Would you agree with that?
I would. I would add a little to that in terms of, you know, we have a history of institutional discrimination in our nation, and we see the health outcomes from that on a daily basis. I think a great series of videos to watch if you're ever interested in it is a program called Unnatural Causes, which really spells out for you how health outcomes are related so much to social determinants of health. I think also, Aaron, connecting back for housing, you know, I don't have an easy solution for that. It's not my job to find the solution, I'm sure. My job is to drive down rates of lead poisoning and exposure, and that gets me into the field of social services and housing and weatherization and any other source of funding I can find to reduce lead hazards in housing. You know, but yeah, it all, I agree with you.
I have a quick question, Fran.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for the presentation.
No problem.
I definitely got more information than I had before, even though I've heard part of your presentation before. When you have 78.2% of housing stock was built prior to 1980, is there a percentage of that housing stock that there has been some lead abatement, and that that particular stock now is in a better condition. And so the last meeting we had last Wednesday, one of the speakers was talking about lists, if I'm not mistaken, that are given out by housing authorities. Like when someone comes in with their Section 8 voucher and they're trying to find a place to live, they have a list of landlords that they mm-hmm. refer them to, and that is problematic in and of itself. But is there a healthy homes list of housing stock that's been identified where there once was a problem with lead, but now there are no health hazards or problems there? And so that would seem like a much better list to put together than a list of, homes that have repeatedly, had lead in them, and then we keep giving out that same, mm-hmm. lead list to everybody instead of coming up with a list that may,
We collect data on where environmental lead abatement is done on properties associated with disease. So for children who have blood lead greater than 20 or the two 15 to 19, 3 months apart. So we do have a huge number of and list of property addresses throughout the state that have gone through lead abatement where it was completed and cleared. Where we run into issues with it is you could have, for instance, the wall behind you is entirely intact. And if I test it and if it's lead-based paint, that doesn't actually pose a health risk to you and I. It's not a friction surface. There's no real way for you to become exposed to lead unless you were to lick the wall, literally. Most two-year-olds don't lick walls. They'll do hand-mouth activity, and dust from friction surfaces that contributes to that exposure. So that intact lead-based paint wall is left alone or placed on a management plan. So we could run a list of properties in the state where lead abatement has been completed over the past probably 5 to 10 years, no problem. But we don't know if today, January 15th, 2014, if that wall is still intact. We know when it was cleared and that it was intact at the time that the lead abatement was approved and finalized. And so that's where it becomes an issue for us, is that ongoing maintenance piece, and that's where Judy DeCine steps in and says we need international property maintenance code adopted. But we do have a list. Yes, we could generate that out of our disease surveillance system. It wouldn't be complete, but it would be some. I think the HUD grantees could also generate lists.
Aaron, do you remember how many RAP certificates are issued yearly? Is it 20,000? That number comes to mind. I'm not sure.
I'm not going to recall. No.
Okay. But I just want to make clear that none of this that we have spoken about for Section 8 applies to RAP certificates. Is that right?
Well, there are state laws on lead that would apply to RAP. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're in a three-family home and there's deteriorated paint in a pre-1978 structure, it would still be cited as a housing violation. And even though under HUD subpart M doesn't apply to the rental assistance program that's administered by state funds, I believe that they voluntarily adopt those HUD standards when reviewing the properties just for standardization and uniformity's sake. If a lead-based paint hazard is identified through a paint chip sample or X-ray fluorescent, where these little guns you shoot into the wall, it's radioactive, bounces back, tells you if it's a toxic level of lead. If those methods identify a lead-based paint surface and it's deteriorated and a child under the age of 6 is in residence, that's also required to go through lead abatement under our public health code. So there's an intersection and overlapping of federal, state, and housing laws.
Sorry. Is the state code more strict than the federal code? So we end up with the same thing at the end?
The same outcome in the end.
Yes,
you do. For years, HUD had the requirement for lead-safe work practices in their HUD-funded properties or federally assisted properties. After 2010, with the U.S. EPA's adoption of the Renovation, Remodeling, and Painting Rule, any pre-1978 residential structure where a rental property owner, do-it-yourselfer, or someone hired does the work to correct old painted surfaces. That also needs to be done lead safe. So they're pretty uniform.
Okay, so just to be clear, whether you have a people who are using the wrap vouchers, the properties available to them fall under the same legal lead requirements as Section 8 vouchers. We don't have. What I'm trying to get at is, do we have to worry about the properties accepting wrap vouchers that they might have higher lead incidents just because of requirements or lack of requirements?
No, I think you don't have to make a distinction. If there's deteriorated paint in a pre-1978 structure, it's citable under 47A, 54, or 52, depending upon the number of units. And under 24 CFR subpart or part 35, which is the HUD requirements, that same instance, they would both say to a property owner, you need to correct these painted surfaces using lead safe work practices.
Sure.
I have a question. If a landlord wants to opt out of the Section 8 program, they either, one, don't want to rent to someone who has a Section 8 voucher, or they have decided that they no longer want to rent to someone who has a Section 8 voucher because the government is too involved in their business and requiring them to make, you know, changes or fix their property and make it healthy and safe and so forth. A landlord could conceivably do that by being cited and then not correcting the problem within the deadline that they're given, within the 30 to 90 days that they're given to do so. Has there been any thought given to referring those landlords to the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities? Because under state law, a landlord is required to participate in the Section 8 program. They can't opt out. They can't say that I don't take Section 8.
Right.
I'm not going to rent to someone who has a Section 8 certificate. But that is a backdoor way
it's a path
of doing it. Mm-hmm. And if then the state agency charged with enforcing the anti-discrimination laws as they relate to housing is not notified in some way or has no idea, then many landlords are going to be allowed to engage in that activity and will never know. And so then we're like reducing the housing stock, and in this particular case it's a housing stock that has lead in it, which is wouldn't be healthy for kids. But if there are all these resources available potentially to landlords to fix their property, has anyone given any thought to you know, creating some type of referral system or making one state agency or municipality making another state agency aware of what's going on so that information sharing occurs, and then we probably can curb some of the unhealthy homes that are out there because we can connect the landlord to the resources that they need to fix it, and we can at the same time enforce the anti-discrimination laws which require landlords to participate in the Section 8 housing program.
In general, code enforcement officials, whether it's a local health professional, local health department, or a local housing code enforcement, are not involved with the voucher-based program inspections and that deferral process that you're talking about. We don't even learn about it. It's really from my state-level data that we started to identify this trend, and through the meetings that we identified, there's that kind of passive non-compliance that by default then allows a property owner to fall out of the Section 8 voucher-based programs in the state by not complying within that 90 days. So there's that deferral of the unit. So during our meetings, we had discussions about, among a lot of the partners, they brought up, well, why don't you make a referral to local health or housing? Because a rental is a rental. One of my concerns with taking the property owner who wants to rent to a property and it's voucher based is that we create two different systems for rental housing, and there aren't two different systems in our state for rental housing. There's one, and the source of funding that pays for that rent on a monthly basis is the difference. That's it. But a rental unit is a rental unit in our state. That's been shown through state case law. So if that's the case, we shouldn't have that kind of backdoor sneaky way for someone to get out of renting to a voucher-based person, but then somehow taking that same unit and renting to somebody who's not voucher-based. Well, to me, from a purely lead perspective, there's a lead hazard for them and they're voucher-based, and there's a lead hazard and they're not voucher-based. I don't care, right? Like, that's still a lead exposure for a child. So for me, I think there needs to be a greater communication between housing-based programs and local code enforcement. We see it in places, I'm going to be like Waterbury is an example where they're building that network. Bridgeport, Connecticut has a certificate of apartment occupancy program where they do lead inspections on turnover and at certain time intervals. We don't have one in New Haven. Norwalk has a housing code. Part of Quinnipiac Valley Health District, the city of Hamden, has a housing code. She started working with her housing authority to identify the units that were subsidized, to identify which types of complaints were coming in, if she should refer them back to the housing authority to address, for instance, or accompany the health department on their inspections. That's where Judy Deceen comes from with we need an international property maintenance code, is that there are 169 different ways of doing this. And for me at a state level, for you at a state level, that's 169 different people. You might as well double that because you have housing and health, and then triple that because you're going to add voucher-based, and then quadruple that because the voucher-based is actually administered by 2 to 3 different entities, right? So it becomes this unmanageable problem, and the solution would be more along the lines of an international property maintenance code being adopted in Connecticut. That's my humble opinion. but I agree with you that some sort of referral system could happen, but it would not come from the Department of Public Health or even local housing code enforcement. It would have to come from the voucher-based program administrators.
I did have another question about you and your partners in the collaboration. For instance, the weatherization program, you know, they go in and they start testing, you know, set up, and all of a sudden a part of what they're looking at, they discover lead, some lead. They just pack up their equipment and leave because they're not licensed to deal with it or do anything with it. Is there any obligation for them to report it to anyone?
So I've worked with the weatherization programs, and this kind of moves away from lead more to healthy homes. So our weatherization programs in our state have funding sources from both the federal government as well as through ratepayer funds. And they're supposed to weatherize homes, businesses throughout the state. The governor has a lofty goal. As part of that, we connected partners, for instance, the HUD Lead Abatement Program administrators in Bridgeport, New Haven, Hartford, Waterbury are all very familiar with United Illuminating or CLMP, depending upon which company covers their area. So that what might happen is someone might call and say, I want to get my rental property weatherized. And if the contractors go out there, UI or CLMP, and they identify deteriorated asbestos or what looks to be like asbestos, because they're not testing, or they see a lot of deteriorated paint, what they'll now do is they actually make a referral to LAMP or the HUD grantee, and they've aligned their forms so the income eligibility requirements are parallel. So there are several different weatherization programs offered in the state, but the income-eligible one is usually the one a HUD grantee will have. So, for instance, if you're out there and you're UI and CLMP and this family is income-eligible, the tenants are, then they're also eligible for lead abatement funds. So what happens is LAMP or the HUD grantee in Waterbury or New Britain or New Haven or Bridgeport will do the lead abatement, do the healthy homes fixes, and they'll coordinate that work with UI and CLNP and sometimes even share the cost. So, for instance, a weatherization company might pick up 50% of the cost of the vinyl replacement windows that the licensed lead abatement contractor installs. All right. So there's this now meshing or dovetailing of funds so that housing rehab is done in a more coordinated manner in our state so that we don't overlap or duplicate services, and at the same time that we don't interrupt people's lives. You don't want six people out at your home at different times. Like, if you can coordinate that work, it's less of an inconvenience to the families and tenants.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that. And this is for the families that are within the acceptable income levels.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And how about those who fall outside of that?
Well, like you and me, we pay for that work. But I'll give you an example.
Wait, before you say we pay, now, I mean, paying means that we either know there's a problem and we want to fix the problem because we're, you know, responsible
right.
owners and we may
right.
have children, or it could mean that we know about it and, you know, I can't afford to do anything about it. Or
right.
if nobody's notified locally that there's a problem, then I'm...
You get away with it. To
right.
a certain extent, and so, hopefully you don't poison your kids in the interim.
Right. So how does that usually play out? I mean...
For the CLMP and UI contractors who are pre-approved through their vendor contracts, they've all gone through training related to lead safe work practices. So they don't hold the licensing as a lead abatement company because they're not doing lead abatement. They're not going out and testing and saying, this surface has lead and therefore I want to remove it. They're going out and saying, I want to weatherize this property. This home has single pane windows. We recommend, you know, window replacement, right? So when they do that window replacement, under federal law, they're still supposed to do it using lead safe work practices. And so they have the certification and training to do that legally. I can't control whether they do it legally or not, but we do checks on these contractors. We actually do outreach to all of them. One of the reasons they're all certified is because of our program and the outreach we've done. So that they're doing that window replacement in a lead-safe manner regardless. Now, if there's a child under the age of six and the home is tested and the child's lead poisoned, then that's a different level. That's orders are issued by a director of health. You need to have the work pre-approved by the director of health, an acceptance of the terms of how lead abatement will be done, and who you're going to hire to carry out that lead abatement and how it will be performed and when it will be completed. That's followed up by dust wipe samples where they clear the work at the end to show there's no existing lead hazard after the work is completed. Okay? So there's two different systems at play.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your presentation.
No problem.
Any other questions before we close out? Aaron?
I guess I just want to add that it's, you know, the work that the Department of Health is doing and that Francesca's team is doing is so very important, but it's also something that if we had done affordable housing correctly, we wouldn't have had to do it all.
Right.
So I just want to make sure that that's sort of the big point here and how much it's all costing us and the impact on the lives of people from the perspective of this task force. So
right.
Just
and
just
I think
that.
We have to consider how we define affordable housing
mm-hmm.
and take into account the costs of health outcomes when calculating affordable.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Sure.
Oh, you
go,
have another question?
Sure.
All right, that's
she
fine.
Has 10 more questions.
No.
I mean, okay,
I
maybe two.
No, is there any cost estimate as to, you know, how much the in terms of the health impact on the state, you know, by not having healthy homes, how much is it costing the state so we can, like, have something to compare it to? Because if we're spending, you know, an extra $100 million on health care and education and, you know, funding all of these, you know, programs
yeah.
and actual in-school programs because we don't have fair housing and affordable housing for people, then it would seem like if we could only have to spend $1 million or $2 million that we would then be saving $198 million when you look at it that way. Has anyone, like, you know, gathered that?
I think there are some national studies that show those types of numbers. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be just lead. When you look at it, there are a lot of different health outcomes associated with the home environment or the immediate surrounding area. Aaron brought up chronic diseases, type 2 diabetes, obesity, heart disease, inactivity. But you also have, you know, exacerbation of asthma due to environmental triggers, because asthma itself is a chronic disease, so I don't want to, it's not all environmental, but it does exacerbate or worsen it, and we see the highly severe cases of asthma occurring in those same municipalities as lead. The greatest ED visits associated with asthma attacks in those urban centers. So I think the asthma program does have some numbers in terms of the cost just from the five large cities right on the DPH website, if you want to get an idea of that. We never ran numbers for cost specific to Connecticut. We're a relatively small program, believe it or not. It's my two EPIs who run 82,000 results a year and generate this report, and only three other staff who do the case management statewide. So you're talking about five key staff members doing all of this work.
Thank you.
Quick question on this chart.
Yes.
What is the time frame? Is this new cases within the past 12 months?
Oh, that's 2012 data. So calendar year 2012.
Sorry, I was putting it together quickly.
It's been great.
You've really given us a lot of good information.
And the housing data, I don't think that's cited either. That was U.S. Census Bureau 2000. Just so you know, for the percentage of homes pre-1960 and 1980. It's U.S. Census data. Thank you.
Again, thank you for your presentation.
No problem. Have a good day.
Our next meeting is a week from today, January 22nd. Look forward. Yes, and Department of Housing and DCF will be here making presentations. All right. Have a good day.